Hello and welcome to the Swine Time Podcast. I am your host, Spencer Wayne. I'm one of the staff veterinarians here at Pipestone. I'm also one of the owners in Pipestone Holdings, and I have one of my partners here, Cameron Schmidt, one of our other veterinarians. And before I let him take over on the conversation, just to introduce him a little bit from my perspective, there is veterinarians, and then there's veterinarians, and there's also farmers veterinarians, and Cameron's both. Cameron's great on the farm, and Cameron is also the smartest guy I know on bugs and drugs, and when I get stumped, I call Cameron. So Cameron's my guest today, and we pretty much just gave him free rein. Cameron, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, what you're interested in, and start the conversation.
Thanks, Spencer, for the great introduction. I'm a veterinarian here at Pipestone. I've been at Pipestone since 2002 when I got out of college, so I've been here my whole career. Lived in Pipestone for about 5 years and moved to Independence, Iowa, and still travel throughout the system. Today, my role is Executive Vice President of Pipestone Veterinary Services. So all the happenings within the clinic locations, I'm in charge of, which is a new role for me. Previously, I was a multiplication health director, and I've worn many hats through the years and love the diversity of what I've been allowed to do here.
Okay, so now you're a big-time guy. Have you still got some basic skills in veterinary medicine?
It just added more to my plate. It doesn't seem like much fell off. I still get to farms, you know, probably 4 days out of a week and have some more admin functions.
So. Excellent. Okay, the topic is health/diseases.
Yep.
And I was thinking if you want to talk about some things, there's a whole list of different pathogens. There's some things that are not pathogenic, like pig vices, prolapse. There's a whole bunch of stuff. You just take it where you want, and I'll see if you really are smarter, as smart as I think you are or not.
Well, let's start out with the big bugs, right? PERS being number one for the industry. You know, if you look at the University of Minnesota data, it would actually suggest this PERS year is lower, and you know, for our system, we've had 3 or 4 great years in a row. The industry is probably seeing fewer PERS breaks. Mm-hmm. The dilemma is that data doesn't capture severity, right? And as we've added the lineage 1 family viruses, the 144, right, our PERS break frequency appears to be going down, but our severity has probably gone up, right? Mm-hmm. And with the current markets, a lot of producers, if they get hit with 144, rather than dealing with high wean pig cost because of lower throughput, you know, and poor quality pigs, and have been able to go to the open market and source out clean pigs. And we, you know, in my career, we really haven't done depop repops. Mm-hmm. And in the last 2 to 3 years, depop repop has really become, you know, in mode again, and that's somewhat driven by market, but yeah, it's also driven by severity of these 144s.
Yeah, you just stumbled into kind of an interesting area because you're right. You and I practicing work with the South Farms. You break with PERS. Well, you get rid of PERS, but you get a disease, you get rid of it. You never depop the farm until the last few years because weird things. I think it started with COVID because the economics got so extreme. You said we should depop this farm. It got to be way more appealing, and then you realized how a clean stocking was so much better than an older population that had never been freshened up essentially for a long time.
Right. And some of your other guests have talked about the quote, quote, new health paradigm that you know, we've observed when we do a reset on these farms, and they're a great opportunity to get rid of your high pass strep or your bad parasuus that you deal with. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of other cooties that we've accumulated in these farms, you know, that have never been depopulated since they started up, you know, sometimes in the 90s, mm-hmm. right? And where those bugs accumulate from are, you know, your historic gilt sources, right? If you've been single source from a very high health gilt source forever, you probably have really clean pigs, and mm-hmm. a depop repop probably doesn't create a lot of value for you.
Yeah.
But if you've accumulated, you know, all the underlying agents to go with it, a restart might make sense. Yeah. And realize market is part of the equation on this thought.
Right. So kind of circle back around, like you got a farm, you have a average mediocre farm for health, whatever it might be. You get PRRS today. The cost is so extreme in the face of really poor profitability. You might depop the farm.
Right.
And the backside of that, you get this crazy advantage of I got a single clean stocking and now I'm like it's a fresh brand new farm again.
Right.
And you get all the advantage of having that versus 20 plus years of an accumulated bug load with all the small bugs.
Yep.
Is essentially what you're talking about. Yep. So on this topic of PRRS, you said it's maybe less breaks, but more severe. I hadn't sensed that, but I live further away from PRRS country than you.
Yeah, no, it you know, generally if your herd gets 1.44 today, and this may be an overgeneralization, but extremely common to have 6 to 12 weeks where you literally don't have pigs to wean or the very few pigs you have left, right? If you got a 6,000 sow farm weaning 50 pigs a week, right, that creates zero value for wean to finish producer.
And that's still the lineage 1.44 lineage 1C variant, the same one we had 4 years ago.
Like, right. And it's mutated. You know, there's 1.24s and there's other cut patterns, right? The RFLP language we really should go away from, but mm-hmm. it's still what we use.
It's the same virus though, changed slightly. It's not correct. A new one. It's the correct. Same one.
Yep.
For the last 3 to 4 years,
yep.
And it's still as bad.
That's generally how PRRS viruses have gone, right? We get a new severe variant, right? And for 3 to 5 years, we're dealing with that one. Then we get almost a step mutation where it's that much worse the next mm-hmm. time, you know? And you can think back to 1.182s and 1.84s and 1.74s and, mm-hmm. you know, on and on
yeah.
back through our career, But right now it happens to be the 1.44 lineage 1Cs that are the really bad guys. Unfortunately, what has historically spawned is if we're 3 years into this guy, we're not far from the new big bad guy, right? Mm-hmm. And frustratingly, the tendency is as we keep getting years and years and years further into PRRS, we tend to get more and more severe cases.
Right.
So, but the other is with the break frequency down, it does appear that as people have moved more to depop, right, we are placing less hot pigs out into the environment, mm-hmm. you know, around other farms, and that might be why the frequency of breaks is down, because we're just shutting off supply mm-hmm. and not infecting others. That's a hypothesis. I'd love to be able to prove it. Some epidemiologist who's way smarter than me can probably prove that somehow in the data, but that's yeah. what it feels like.
As far as managing PRRS, if you look through Iowa and your practice area and just people and systems and other people you're aware of raising pigs, when you get PRRS today, I know our approach would be most of the time, oh, do an elimination, close and eliminate the virus and go back to either negative truly or a vaccinated wild virus negative farm. Is that common or what are most people doing to manage their PRRS now?
I mean, right, that's been the model for 10 to 15 years now. The dilemma with these 1.44s, they seem to be extremely sticky. Our historical, you know, load, close, homogenize, 40 weeks, for example, they're less successful today. I don't know what the percentage is, but we've had many, many closure failures or closures that we have to extend. Then obviously you have the next set of problems that occur when your closure doesn't work, right? You're now still making positive pigs and you're out of guilt.
Yeah. With a messed up parity structure.
Right. You're no longer have gilts to breed. So you cull less, right? Mm-hmm. So animals you would normally put on a truck, you're retaining your herd. They're less productive. They die at a higher rate. So PRRS continues to give us frustrating curveballs. You know, the other side of this poor market and what we've seen is generally the sow farms are located in worse areas that break every year. They've just become unprofitable to operate. And the model that we've seen really emerge to work is locate your sow farm out of pig dense area.
Right.
You pay a freight basis, right, to get that clean pig from a low dense area into the feeding area. And at least I've got a clean pig to start off from. Then the downstream systems are somewhat variable, right? Some systems, at least we start with a clean wean pig. I know I'm 70 or 90% likely to see PRRS during the growing phase. At least we see some benefit with vaccine. But vaccine is, you know, still very frustrating, right? And some systems have gotten rid of sites or contract sites and known bad areas where group after group after group breaks. Mm-hmm. Other systems just put their head down and say that's within the cost of operating. I'm near my packer. I'm near my feed mill. I'm going to feed pigs here, come hell or high water. And
that's, to me, that's new. Sows not being in pig dense areas is not new. That's been like, oh, that's a natural gravity because it dictates you go somewhere to keep that source clean. But for somebody to say, I'm not going to have pigs in northwestern Iowa because of too much disease, I'm like, that's where they got to be. That's where the everything's there. They need the manure. They got the plants close by. The feed's all there. You're seeing places where I'm not going to put pigs there because even a clean pig gets too sick. It's not worth it.
Yeah, definitely.
Really.
And different systems value different production metrics differently. Some systems, you know, it's percent grade A. Some systems, it's feed conversion. And they are intertwined to some degree. Mm-hmm. But you add animal health costs, antibiotics and treatment and labor frustrations. Some systems have said, you know, I don't need to be in this pig dense zone. Get me to somewhere slightly pig dense. And we've seen that also, like, I'll use an example out in South Dakota where when we started putting sow farms out there, there were no growing pigs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now they're growing pigs, yeah. You know, encroaching on what we thought were unbelievably biosecure sites 15 mm-hmm. years ago. And now there's some finishers around. And yeah. so you are seeing migration, and to some degree, it's system design, right?
Yeah.
People design their system with a nursery and two finishers on one site, right? That model is...
You wouldn't do that now, typically.
Right. Yeah, the nursery may be shut down. The two finishers are run as all in, all out. We've gone on with PRRS quite a while there.
This PRRS is making me nauseous, actually.
But the other majors, right, were, 95% mycoplasma-free, and mycoplasma does not appear to be an easily moved agent. I don't want to say mycoplasma is dead, but from where I started in my career to now, it's not even my top five problem list, generally.
And it was an ever-present thing that, at first, nobody thought we could get rid of it. People
right.
were trying. It was like so hard. And I remember people at academic levels saying, there's no such a thing as a mycoplasma negative farm. You can only suppress it. But now it's like, no, that's not true at all. You can get rid of it. And what's interesting on that is where we've eliminated it on a farm, as long as the pigs are flowing out clean, I have seen no problem just flowing it out of a system.
Yep.
You don't even have to like be super segregated on your production flow downstream like you would with PRRS. It just kind of... It must be so slow and heavy that all you got to do is just put clean pigs in and eventually they all get clean all the way to market.
Mycoplasma pneumoniae just does not transmit as easily as our virus. And that should make sense, right? A bacterial, or a pseudobacterium is much more difficult to transfer. Mm-hmm. And that's what all the data would say. So mycoplasma, PED is one of the big ones that in general is very low prevalence. There's some systems that... I'd say live with it because they have poor transport infrastructure. They won't wash their trailers or they do a fire hose wash. And usually systems like that start breaking with PED when the weather gets cold. So December, January, then every finisher breaks until May. Mm-hmm. And then the cycle gets broken because Mother Nature gives heat. And PED is one of those agents that, frankly, from a national standpoint, we shouldn't have.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I'm wondering, is there any thought of why don't we make this is a disease we could actually get rid of if we wanted to.
Yep.
I haven't heard of anybody seriously talking about doing
it's
that,
been talked at US SHIP, but there are a few systems that have not invested in biosecurity as heavily as other systems have. And until that happens, you got a few bad apples that make all of us have to play more defense on PED.
Yeah, but it's dramatic when it happens, but the response, the immune response of the exposure, it must be so incredible that Right. With, like, you just have to whisper it out almost when it gets done with it. Just be, take basic steps and the thing is gone from an isoween unit, maybe right. not a ferro to finish unit, but an isoween unit.
Right. Right. PED is really not a difficult agent to get out of farm. You know, I'll take PED, you know, every day and twice on Sunday over a purse break mm-hmm. because you basically have a 30-day downtime. You do get some, if you can put a silver lining in a cloud of PED, you do get a clean out of your farrowing house, mm-hmm. which may clean out some influenzas, some other circulating things in your farrowing house. But of the majors, PERS, PED, mycoplasma, you know, influenza, I don't know if it counts in the big disease bucket. A lot of farms are endemic. We've been very successful on moving our system. I think today we're about 65% influenza negative, and we've got a good cleanup tool that is, you know, very repeatable. The dilemma really on the flu side is, and the pressure has been applied to our multiplication companies of not only do we expect a PERS negative guild, a myco negative guild, a PED negative guild, now we expect a influenza negative guild, mm-hmm. And they're getting there. But for some systems that are endemically flu positive, it's not a big deal for them. You know, it doesn't cause the economic strain that a PERS or a PD break does. It's just more of a nagging problem.
And flu is a little special too. And here's a real example from us. One farm I work with, one farm is another one of our partners works with. Two filtered units that were truly flu naive, like didn't even have flu exposure. They were vaccinated, but had never seen flu in their life. All the people get sick one day that work on these farms. They were fairly close together. Exactly the same time, all the sow herd gets sick. And so how'd the sows get sick? I'm like, well, filtered barns that had never had any flu. All of a sudden they get it. Both identical virus. The farms weren't even close to each other, but the people lived close to each other.
Yep.
It was definitely, it seems, and that, people brought it in.
Yeah,
and that's part unique about flu.
That's part of the, you know, right, flu circulates between swine, human, and fowl populations. Mm-hmm. And you can see jumps from human to pigs or vice versa. You know, we had swine flu or, you know, in 2008, 2009 that wrecked the markets. They do occur. Mm-hmm. They're fairly uncommon, but they do occur. And generally, a human-type strain that gets into pigs is not terribly well host-adapted. It will cause an immediate epidemic impact to the farm. Mm-hmm. And actually, we've got a case at another farm in South Dakota where it blew in, and within 60 days, it became undetectable. So it definitely was a human-type strain. That's what the sequence would tell us. Mm-hmm. And so the tendency is the human type strains that do get into pig farms tend to be less virulent or have less longevity than an actual swine type variant.
Yeah. So flu is a little goofy because we add this zoonotic human potential into it when you come in. Yep. The people may cause that problem yep. versus PERS. People aren't going to get PERS, but right. flu can.
Yep. And there's a bunch of other bugs that because we've reduced PERS, or reduced mycoplasma, or reduced PED breaks, or reduced influenza, now are becoming, I don't know, as necessarily more prevalent, but because we have less of the big bad ones, we're fighting them more. So one of the big challenges the last 2-3 years has been hemolytic E. coli. Mm-hmm. That really has been a focus area. I think with, you know, some of the tools we've had to come up with that are, you know, right, most of our E. coli's we get today are basically resistant to every antibiotic we have. Mm-hmm. And so we've had to come up with, you know, dietary modulation or changes to the diet to make a more gut-friendly diet, acidification of the water. When we get a hemolytic E. coli break, just something as simple as shutting the feeders off, right? The E. coli needs the corn and soybean meal to eat itself, to propagate and replicate itself. Just shutting feeders off and acidification is generally, at least what I observe today, as successful as whatever antibiotic you want to throw at it.
Yeah. We could easily have a whole conversation just on E. coli because it's, to me, it's kind of fascinating. If you go back 15 years ago, E. coli, oh, which drugs is it sensitive to? And you'd go through a couple maybe or on the same site. You just keep using, you might go to the next drug and you get some effectiveness. You're right. Many E. coli's, nothing works. In fact, we didn't even rely on that as our first line of defense. Now we're sick. You're going right to water acidification, some sanitation measures, shutting feeders off, a lot of oats, you know, just things to modulate the gut environment
right.
entirely, and just say it's got to be less hospitable to growing a big bundle of E. coli inside of an animal. We've got to change that dynamic.
Right.
And you're not even, the antibiotics there, but it's really there as a, oh, okay, that too, but really these other things are the primary focus.
Right. That's, it is frustrating to watch as we've seen E. coli's get more and more resistant over time. And then I'd also say our toolkit, right, Mecadox is again on the block for the FDA trying to get rid of it. There's frustratingly, we've got fewer and fewer tools. And so we've had to get out of the traditional, mm-hmm. you know, I have a bacteria, I apply an antibiotic and I control it. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case with our E. coli's today.
Yeah. Hey, on the topic of E. coli though, I think it's fair to say as the industry has gone more and more red boar, more Duroc, we have more and more E. coli because they have more receptors for E. coli is the,
yep.
is the smart guy language that yep. I've heard. Now, that being said, what's the, is there a solution for that? Are genetic companies focused on less receptor Durox or where is that?
Andy? Yeah, the red boar phenomenon, I think it's actually a couple of things, right? The Durox tend to be binge type eaters. So, mm-hmm. right, they'll eat one or two large meals a day versus snackers of pigs that have a continuous flow of calories or feed through their intestine. And so you get this large bolus of corn and soybean meal into the gut of the pig. And, right, the fastest growing bacteria on the planet is E. coli. Well, it obviously just occupies that ecological niche when you throw a whole bunch of gasoline to mm-hmm. it to burn up, right? So part of it is the eating habit of the pig. Then you have the DR2 receptor, you know, debate, which, you know, some genetic companies really, you know, marketed that in the early 2000s that this yeah. pig is more resistant. And theoretically, the red boar has a significantly lower prevalence of that gene. I'm not a geneticist. It's, you know, I don't know that to be a fact, but that's what I'm told. And so, yeah, you have more receptors on a pig that gorges himself. And that's a great way to create an E. coli bloom in the gut of a pig.
Yeah. It's almost like the combustion chamber in an engine, you know, pulling in fuel and just the explosion that happens.
Yep.
You know, you don't have a smooth passage of fuel and you're loading the container up with combustible material.
Right.
You know, in boluses, big chunks. All right. So E. coli, hit that. Unless there's anything else in your mind, we're about out of time. So what's the last bug that you think is worth?
Yeah, I'd maybe put it into kind of a bucket of, you know, some of the new bugs, right? So, you know, Rota has historically been, you know, caused some neonatal E. coli or neonatal scour in the farrowing house as well as after weaning. We've got this virus called sapovirus that we think in general it's kind of just like Rota, right? It's got, you know, it does about the same thing. It cuts off the tips of the villi in the intestine. We've got a virus called Astrovirus 4 that really looks a lot like a mild influenza. So we'll see pigs start to cough when they're 15 days of age while they're still in the sow, and they may cough for up to a week after weaning. Again, it's not anything like PRRS or severe bugs, but as the technology has improved with next generation sequencing and you know, stuff that's way beyond my understanding. You know, I'm now 22 or 23 years out of vet school. The technology is now finding all these bugs. And what we're having a tough time sorting is that just a commensal virus that happens to be there, it's really not causing a problem for the pig, or is it actually doing some damage? And, mm-hmm. and right, we'll learn more over time, right? And it might be what we find is, well, if you have PRRS plus Astrovirus 4, the PRRS is more severe. Or yeah. if you've got Astrovirus 4 and influenza, the flu is that much more severe. It doesn't look like they're primary bugs, but they do a little bit of damage that helps the primary bug really create a problem.
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of those that the industry's chasing around right now that you may hear those words and but ask your veterinarian or me or whoever, and at least I can give you the present state of knowledge on a lot of those, what I'll call minor or less major pathogens, however you want to word it. Some cool technologies bring those to the forefront. We're just having a tough time figuring out what their impact is.
Yeah. So. Yeah, we had Darren Mattson on before.
Yep.
And just some of the cool things they've got going on at the Iowa State Diagnostic Lab for detecting some of these is impressive. It just hit me, too, as we're going through this list. We didn't even discuss.
About Circo.
Circo, yeah. It's like PCV2. I just had a case of it recently. But how much of that has just gone in the background as we've got a good set of vaccines that appear to work very well? Like, we don't even think about it anymore.
Right. You know, Circo, for the most part, unless you have some destabilizing event at the South Farm, right, we've got very good vaccines. And if we, you know, not to take up too much of your time here, but most vaccines are frankly not very good, right? They're very, you know, over the history of any mammalian vaccine, right? The gold standard, right, is polio vaccine, right? Creates sterilizing immunity, meaning if you've had the vaccine, you can't get the disease. Circo vaccines are not quite that good, but they're dang close. Mm-hmm. Whereas like PRRS vaccine, we see a 50% reduction in whether it's lesions or gain or whatever metric you want to look at. Most vaccines are a lot more like PRRS vaccines than they are like Circo vaccines. Mm-hmm. And so in general, when you have a great tool, getting control is not that hard. The frustrating thing is for, you know, the vaccinologist is to figure out, you know, right, and they've been working on PRRS for dang near 40 years now, and we're frankly still in 1991 when the first PRRS vaccine came out. All the PRRS vaccines are, for the most part, me-toos.
Yeah, right? It is pretty amazing how that there's been zero advancement on a better vaccine for 20 years or more. How many have it been? 20 years at least? Something like that.
30, yeah.
30? Yeah, if I do the math right. Okay. Hey, Cameron, thanks for coming on the show today. Well, I appreciate you being here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Want to also thank our listeners for tuning in. Please tune in next time for the next episode of Swine Time Podcast here at Pipestone.
Swine Time Podcast was created for the pork industry and individual pork producers around the country. Hosted by me, Dr. Spencer Wayne, with the Pipestone Veterinary Services. The podcast contains pork industry news, advancements in animal care, and how to enhance your productivity. Monthly podcasts are available on Spotify, Google Music, iTunes, Anchor, and on www.pipestone.com.